On September 25, 2012, poet Tracy Brimhall came to Writer House to talk to poet Kendra Hamilton about her new book, Our Lady of the Ruins. Her topic, The Quest and the Question, a Mid-Apocalyptic Pilgrimage in Verse.
I can say in introduction of this book that I think that it is absolutely stunning. It is the winner of this year's Barter Women Poets Prize, judged by Carolyn Forché. There's a really lovely little write-up or description of what the book is about. One of the things that I will say about it is that this is Tracy's second book of poetry, which is I think quite incredible. The first book is Rookery, which is right here for sale, and I'm positive that I read this book when it came out in 2010. And one of the things that was always struck me about her work was just the incredible writing about the natural world and a complete lack of sentimentality, which I think is quite refreshing and quite unusual and gets us away from the, you know, sort of pastoral tropes that that are not only stale, but they're also very connected with the sort of master narratives of our culture in kind of ways that are very sort of deceptive and destructive. So this is a really fresh and original new voice, and I highly, highly, highly recommend this book. It's called Our Lady of the Ruins, and I'm going to get Tracy to talk about this in more, but I'll just read you a little bit. The sophomore collection by the award-winning poet Tracy Brimhall, her first book won the Crab Orchard Prize. Which is a very prestigious first book prize, make up a myth in verse that tracks a group of women through their pilgrimage in a mid-apocalyptic world, exploring war, plagues, and the search for a new god in exile. These poems create a chorus of wanderers haunted by empire, god, and personal trauma. And I think that that is quite literally a very fine description of what is going on in this book. Just, I mean, as an introduction, Tracy, would you mind reading the first poem in the book? And so that is, I'm always interested in the way a collection starts. And so if we could just sort of talk a little bit about that poem and why you chose it and, you know, sort of like the development of your voice.
Sure. This poem is called Music from a Burning Piano. Imagine half the world ends and the other half continues in a city made holy by pilgrims who wander to it. They stare at a saint's hand in the reliquary unchanged. Every day the same parade of radiance and crows. Every day thirsting for edible gods. Priests lie well enough to save their own lives. Yes, everything is alive, but not equally loved. Imagine children are named the new historians. Streets forget the revolution. Imagine a piano lit on fire and pushed off a roof. Music falls past windows, but it never meets its shadow. We know it disappeared by the generation of silence. When we visit wild acres and return, the sky moves beneath our skin. Prison guards brand execution dates onto condemned bodies, reminding flesh what the brain relinquished, a century in an hourglass, skin a scaffolding of cells. It's not how much you suffer, but where. Prisoners peel new scabs and watch travelers arrive from a vanishing road, listen for hammers striking burning strings. I think it was sort of a toss-up where to begin the book.
Mm-hmm.
Between Music from a Burning Piano and the poem that appears second, which is called Prelude to a Revolution.
Which I love also. And
I think because they both suggest beginnings.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I went with Music from a Burning Piano because it asks you to imagine. It invokes the imagination, and all of the book is in this imagined universe in which all women of all wars are wandering their exile together mid-apocalypse. So to invoke the imagination as the first word, as the first move in the book,
mm-hmm.
so that suggests the role, the important role, the directive, imagine. So it's not even a request. It's a directive.
Right, right.
Imagine, uh-huh. imagine. And what that world is like. So it sort of introduces you to the world these women live in and also begins with a directive but also an appeal to that imagination to wander with them. And another one of the ideas that is important to the book is present here, which is confinement versus wandering. So mm-hmm. there are pilgrims wandering, and the city is holy because of their wandering. And then there are also prisoners in the sacred town who are confined. So while most of the poems in the book feature a wandering, there's a 7-page poem in the middle of the book called Hysteria, a Requiem, in which all of the women are trapped because there is a plague. So they've trapped themselves in a building to wait out the plague. So there is this tension between freedom and confinement, even in this post-war exile.
So what is the story of the book? I mean, how did you get to... You know, did you start with a sort of a plan, an image? Did you suddenly look up one day and realize that you had a sequence? You know, what was sort of, how did you create this? It's in 6-7 sections, like 6 sections with a coda. I mean, maybe that, I don't know if that's the correct word. But there are these groupings that, you know, take you through these different sort of states of consciousness, these different places, these different kinds of challenges. But then, you know, it's got this beautiful design to it. So how did you, you know, when did you discover where you were in the middle of this world?
Well, the first poem I wrote towards the new book is called Our Bodies Break Light. And it was after going to this museum in the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and at the top of a staircase was this freestanding door. So it wasn't like a door hung. It wasn't a room. It had a barricade around it. It was art. You couldn't touch it. But each panel of this wooden door was carved with scenes of colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a murdered indigenous population, butchered animals, a devastated landscape. And I remember thinking about how would it change you if you had to lay your hands on history to enter a room? Like if you hung the door, this door that has no handles, if you had to push your hand on that to go into a room, how would that change you? And so I wrote this poem and it was in a we voice and I didn't know who we was. And so initially, all of the girls were sisters and they were named after ruined cities. Uh-huh. So one was Carthage, one was Troy, one was Palmyra. So all of these ruined cities across the world, I found one on each continent. And then they had these sort of personas. But then I was going to be really responsible to the history of each place. And I felt like it might over-inform the poems. And as much as I loved the idea of women named for ruined cities, I cut that so that I could just have the freedom to mean every time and all time existing at once. Just history collapsed in on itself rather than making it a history book.
Yeah.
To let it speak to the past and the present and the future in a way that it can't if the women are named after cities. And as far as the structure of the book goes, the way I felt when writing this book was that the book already existed, or the world existed,
yes.
And then I would just tear through the fabric of the world and peek my head in and look around to see what was happening and write whatever was there. I was living in my car at the time I wrote much of this, so the wandering was really easy to write. I wrote the 7-page long confinement poem after I had an apartment again. although in many ways it was preferable, but you know, I had a coffee pot. I didn't have to drink gas station coffee when I had an apartment. But so the structure, so I had all of these poems, and I didn't quite know what it was for a long time. But then once I had more poems, once I was ready to see it as a final thing, which, as a side note, I'm going to come right back. My master's thesis, it wasn't the worst thing that ever happened to me, but I think it did damage to the book because it put it in a final form, and then I couldn't unsee it that way. And so I'm not sure that Rookery would have been the book it is if I hadn't been forced to put it in a final version before I was ready. It's not my master's thesis. It's a different book, but I could no longer conceive of that framework I'd put on it stayed because I couldn't see it any other way. But so for the structure of the book, I wanted to wait until I was sure I was ready to let it have a final form and not condemn it to a form it wasn't ready for yet. But I took a cue from the line by Muriel Rukeyser, "Do I move towards form? Do I use all my fears?" And so The book is actually organized around my grandmother's predictions for the apocalypse. So she has these predictions for the apocalypse, which she taught us when we were young, that the world would end on a jubilee year. And so the jubilee year outlined in Leviticus is taking these seven crops and rotating in seven fields over these seven-year cycles. So seven times seven, you get 49. And then the 50th year is a jubilee year in which all sins are forgiven. Everyone can return home. Debts are forgiven.
Right.
It's just a party year because you've saved up enough grain to have just a big party. So there are seven sections of seven poems.
Yeah.
And then the last poem, the coda, is Jubilee, and my own translation of Leviticus for the Jubilee poem. And so that, it took some, you know, I cut a few things and added a few things and moved some things around, but that really strict form made me be tough on myself and tough on the poems for what could make the cut. I think it's actually just 44 poems that made the cut for the book. So
and
I had to be pretty tough.
Have?
70, 80, I don't know, something.
Wow.
A lot didn't make
the
cut.
So it was like you had the design. This is what Jean Rhys talks about, is that she has, she always had a design for each and every one of her books and wrote reams, but only what fit into the design was what ended up in the book. So, you know, that was why they talk about the modernists revere her for her use of form. So, I mean, that's something that comes across really, really clearly and strongly in this book. The thing that, let's just go on with form a little bit more. Most of the book is written in you appear to like couplet and triplet, you know, sort of, and there does seem to be, most of the poems fit on a page, but then there are these longer, denser poems that have you know, that seem to be revising scripture or really looking deeply at moments of history. And then there you have a complete requiem in the poem, complete with all the parts, the Kyrie, the offertorium, you know, the Libre Ma, all of them. So how does that, you know, what ends up happening is that with the interplay of all these, a limited sort of like palette of different types of poems, but yet this dense music gets set up so that there are places where bang, you know, this, you know, something lands. There are these small poems leading up to a moment that is just devastating. And this happens throughout the book. So is that something that, you know, how do you come to that? Is that, that seems like the mark of mature work, you know, this, how do you get, what would you say is the biggest difference between the way that this poem, I mean, this book of poems came to being, and say the way you wrote Rookery, or you know what you were writing 10 years before, what were the lessons that allowed you to create this really just beautifully crafted piece of work?
Well, I'll say with Rookery, I said in the craft talk earlier that I always feel like that's my pimply big glasses teenage self, and I feel a little embarrassed for her, but I love her too. I mean, those are the poems that taught me.
Right.
And I'd say the biggest difference, too, is that most of those poems are influenced by looking directly at another poem and then trying to take a lesson from that. How can I write a poem in one sentence? How can I do this thing? How can I do that thing? And working really hard to understand the basic tenets of craft. Mm-hmm. And so while it might read very emotionally or very whatever, it was just for me exercises to learn how to write good poems. And I think that Our Lady is more playful, even though it's a very dark book about women, war, exile. I felt much more free, and I feel like Our Lady sounds more like me, even though Rookery is more explicitly autobiographical.
Yes.
So even though autobiography is more evident there, I feel like this sounds more like me, and I think only because I learned things about sound, things about structure, things about how to write a line, things about, and also made choices not to do certain things. Like, I've written that kind of poem before, I really want to try to do this thing. And making a few deliberate choices for myself on how to break up with the first book and how to move on to the next thing.
I love that. Breaking up with the first book.
Yeah, I say that poetry is a lifetime love, but there's serial monogamy that keeps you going.
Uh-huh.
And I definitely broke up with the first book, and Our Lady broke up with me. There was a time I just couldn't write it anymore. I kept trying to write the poems, but they just wouldn't come anymore, and it was really hard. It was really awful. But that was also part of how I knew it was time to order, because all of the new poems just weren't working. Uh-huh. And I'm happy to say I've fallen in love again. It took a lot of just, like, one-night stands with poems, but now now the great love has come back, and I'm deeply committed and deeply joyful and in love with the new poems and the opportunity to write them.
Is the new book very different from this one?
It is indeed.
Okay. Well, we'll get to that. I'm not through with this.
Okay, no, I don't want to be.
One of the things that I think is really, I mean, when I was reading this book, I love the ambition. I love the style. That you've got this, like, lean, taut, muscular kind of style that also never, like, you still have that immediacy of the lyric. It's always the moment, you know, the sort of transcendent moment that's there in every poem. But I kept being reminded as I was reading it about that line from Pound. You know, he said years ago about, you know, modernism sort of like destroying the idea of poetry for ladies. And this, I thought, well, this is a woman's voice that so completely disrupts that whole dismissive notion of poetry for ladies. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about gender and how, you know, how this book sort of like lines up with those stereotypes.
Well, one thing that's really surprised me is about half, I'm sure I haven't read every review, but about half of the reviews the book has received have mentioned the absence of men in the book, which really baffled me.
There are a lot of men in the book.
I didn't know what to do with it, because, or like there are figures that could be men or women, but
soldiers,
I also wasn't sure why that representation was important, because to me, I wrote a book about women, not about the absence of men. And so it really is baffling to me, mm-hmm, the focus that other people have on finding men in the book. Or they'd be like, don't think that men are absent. She's got soldiers. She's got doctors. And I'm like, okay, well, that's problematic. Because women can't be soldiers.
On their mind.
Except for priest, you could still make a woman. But, I mean, really, I just wasn't even worried. I just wanted to write about women.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting to me that it's become about the absence of men rather than about women. And so that's just been a real big surprise to me. If I could have predicted what a review might say, like, I could tell you the weaknesses of this book. I could tell you what I think its strengths are. And people don't seem to focus on that so much as they focus on the gender. And it may be in part of women winning a prize for women that makes people want to view it through terms of gender. But it is really interesting that it is a focal point for people. But one of the things, you know, in addition to naming the cities after women, was just, you know, reading the Iliad and Briseis is, you know, a footnote basically to the story. Or Gilgamesh, the only woman is Ishtar, and she's a vengeful goddess who makes a bold rampage through a city. But it's this, like, homosocial love story between two friends and what one friend will do for another. And I just wanted to give women a voice. And mm-hmm. I in Rookery, I do some things where I write a poem for Margaret Garner. I write a poem for women in the Odyssey. I write a poem for women in literature or women in history that don't have a voice. But rather than trying to just pick individual cities or women of history or in literature, I really wanted to try and speak for everybody, which mm-hmm. also has problems mm-hmm. of inclusion and who I'm speaking for and why. Like, some of the book is written in I and some of the book is written in we. And the Requiem in the middle, I don't know if I'll fold it up in case so that people can maybe see, but there are lyrics on the top written in we and the sections on the bottom are written in I. To sort of, because that's, you know, one of the big ideas too, is the collective experience versus the individual experience. Because you can be a part of something collective, you can be a part of a national tragedy, and yet your personal experience is still different. You still participate in that larger cultural narrative, but you have your own narrative, dare I say, counter-narrative, even to the collective narrative that you participate mm-hmm. in and feel yourself a part of. Right. So that is another big tension of the book, of what belongs to we and what belongs to I, and who gets to speak for each experience.
I think that, and it's very, I think it's handled very deftly and very effectively. I mean, I and particularly in the title poem of the book, Our Lady of the Ruins, which is laid out on the page in such a way that it's a challenge to read, and I can imagine it's a challenge to read in a reading setting. Do you want to go there, or should we do another one first? Because there are so many beautiful poems that I would love for you to read. The Revisionist Gospel, or To My Unborn Daughter, or...
Do you want to try reading Our Lady with me, and yes, I'll read the We, and you can read Our Lady, and I'll sort of try and pause, or you can just jump in whenever.
Okay, do you want to read it together?
Does that make sense?
Yeah, let's want to read together the first time, and then, or do you want to try and break the parts up?
I want to try and read together, because okay. I think that is how this poem is meant to be experienced. There is, just to show you visually as we then try and recreate it with our voices, there's sort of two poems. There's one on the left side and one on the right, and the left side is from the We voice, from the human voice, and the one on the right side is all in italics, and it's Our Lady speaking back. So it's the group of wandering women, and then Our Lady who answers them, or just tries to speak at the same time.
Okay, so I'll do Our Lady.
Okay. Our Lady of the Ruins. We exhausted ourselves with every available pleasure, tied ourselves to chairs, naked and disobedient.
Your bodies dusted with the sex of flowers.
Inside our bodies it was night. God knew
it
what we asked for,
that call me,
but would not return our shame.
From the bottom of the lake.
One day the walls wept your image. When we painted over it, your face bled through. Appeared to us in the image of our mother, but penitent, adoring. You should know we are guilty. We raised more demons than we could lay down. So what if we're haunted? So what if we've stopped dreaming?
Nothing followed me.
We are sensitive to the tides and the lighthouse burning for ships that never arrive.
Name every plant.
The rumors are true.
I knew the weather.
Delirium found us. We oiled and kissed a stranger's burnt feet. We held pigeons underwater until their gnarled hearts stopped fluttering in our hands.
In fresh black earth.
When we unwound their intestines looking for the message, we found blood.
Now they push
hollow
mushrooms
bones
through the loam.
Don't tell us we're too
beneath
late.
A fox's skull.
We swear we're not saved.
Now they lead ants to the dead.
We are ravished and unclean. We left blood in the bowl for you in the tips of our fingers.
But now I return.
We forsake the eastern star. Lead us
in
past the hair. Lead us past
shroud.
The ignorant light. Past the God who threatens to love all that we are.
The cross burns.
So, difficult to listen to if what you want to do is understand every word, but I think that's also the point of the poem, that they can't hear each other. And that's part of the problem of prayer for me, is what if we can't hear each other because we're both trying to speak at the same time. But at the same time, I also think part of the message of the poem is that something gets through. We forsake the eastern star, lead us past the ignorant light, past the God who threatens to love all that we are. I was vanishing, but now I return. In a dress sewn from a shroud, I will meet you where the cross burns. So they both end on a rhyme, a subtle embedded rhyme, but for me that means something's getting through because they're able to hear that part of the message, even if it's they hear the music of each other's voice, if they can't hear the words. So for me that's also part of what might be happening in that poem. It's the one that's only one that's this formally difficult. The rest of the poems formally are a little bit easier. But, you know, you did ask about form a little bit earlier, too. And so Gregory Orr, who many people probably know since he's a Charlottesville poet, has his four temperaments of poetry, mm-hmm. of people writing from imagination, story, form, or music. And so we sort of, in the sort of Punnett squares of the four temperaments, I self-declare myself, I am an imagination poet. I think that's also a big difference between the first and the second was when I realized I had permission to imagine and didn't have to write about my sad life or my bad breakup or my whatever, that I could imagine, and that was mm-hmm. just as valid. But so what imagination needs is form and structure, just the way people who work in form need imagination to balance out so they don't become, you know, totally devoted to the meter and not imagine beyond the music. And so for me as an imagination poet, I have these really strict forms because it reins me in. Otherwise, mm-hmm. I could just write a 50-page poem, just go on and on. So for me, form is really effective for me in reining me in and, like,
creating that compression, that, you know, surprise.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I'm addicted to the too muchness. I want everything to be three times as long as it is.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
If I give myself some strict rules, then I am making real choices about what's tough, what's tight, what's mm-hmm. muscular, mm-hmm. what's mm-hmm. musical, and not worrying about, but I want to talk about this thing, and then I want to talk about this thing, and then I want to talk about this thing, and then I could tell you about this. It's really awesome. So I sometimes describe myself also as the dog from Pixar's movie Up. I'm just like busy doing something and then squirrel. And that's kind of how I feel like I am when I write. I'm just constantly distracted and wanting more and putting more things in and not even noticing what's happening in my poem.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So if I make restrictions about size or line length or form, then that will like hold me solid, hold me steady,
right.
Let that imagination work, but let it work inside a particular sized sandbox and not let it play on the whole playground, but just give it a space to play in and keep it contained so that it doesn't get a little bit too crazy. Crazy is fun too, but but to try and control that urge is why I am pretty strict with myself in form.
I want to switch gears just a little bit to something that has been sort of like all through this is, and that is the kind of role of religion in these poems. You're writing about it's unusual for people to be so, for a poet or a writer to be so overtly into this type of imagery, and it's tremendously powerful. We get such beautiful words out of it, like. That, you know, that I remember from my childhood is going to Catholic school, the auto da fe and orison and all of these, this wonderful language of psalm and prayer, and but that is people have not delved into. What is it, you know, that led you in that direction? You know, I don't know very many people who have written poems inspired by Leviticus. Just
it's not a very inspiring.
It's not a very inspiring book of the Bible, you know. Song of Songs, yes. Leviticus, not so much.
Well, I'll also say that the book early on. This is why you don't let form happen too soon. I handed, I think it was about 40 pages to someone, and they said you have Christian poems and you have pagan poems, and I was just like. No, anything but that, because there are representations of other faiths
right.
in this book.
Very much so.
And you know, it does start with a quote from Joseph Campbell, and I was mm-hmm. my minor was cultural anthropology, and I really I'm interested in how people believe and why they believe and what they believe. But a friend this summer asked me when I knew what my question was that drove the second book. And I said, oh, by poem 3. And I said, actually, poem 1, the first poem I wrote that I loved that told me I was in a new relationship with a new book, had the question in it. And it was, is there something worth dying for? Or better yet, is there something worth living for? And I imagined that always to be something greater than myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the book, there is this search for a God, any kind of Madonna, any kind of anything that will answer to provide some meaning for suffering, mm-hmm. to account for suffering, that it's not just Job for the next 2 millennia.
Right.
You know, just like, I don't know, try it out, devil, see what happens, see how he does. But just the desperate belief, too, to think that our suffering has purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I need to believe that. But it is the question that drove the book is there anything out there worth dying for? Is there anything out there worth living for? Because that's also not like, I get up every morning because I love to write poetry, but it's, if I'm absolutely present each day, what feels that? Why is that important? You know, the be the change you wish to see in the world, but also just that, not even that hope for the future, but just the importance of being and being as awake and present as possible and how that could change the world mm-hmm. and how that's necessary perhaps for God too, that if I'm fully awake, that God feels the world through me and how that's necessary. But all of that is a hope and an idea I like
mm-hmm.
and not something I feel like I know for a fact. And Rilke said, live the questions. And so I think my book is trying to live its questions.
So you don't feel that the book resolved the question for you, but that, or that?
When I feel like the last poem is true, mm-hmm. then those days it answered it. Although I find myself writing similar questions still. But there was a great line I stole from Emerson for the book, but it's, "You are the doubter and the doubt." And I guess I have great faith in doubt and what doubt can do for driving the intellect, for driving the mind, for driving the spirit, and how important doubt is to faith. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's an expression of faith rather than the absence of it.
Yes. Okay, I see. Let's hear another poem that I think is kind of... let's look at the revisionist gospel.
Okay.
I think that's a good example of, the way that you're sort of playing with these ideas that, might get it across in a less abstract way than just us talking about it.
So this is the revisionist gospel. "One of my sisters confuses gunfire with the voice of God. She will tell you the book can be decoded. It will reveal where the priests of resurrection hide keys to the armory, where you can purchase your choice of oblivion. The story is about a warship disarmed in the desert, waiting for the flood when, suddenly, rain. One of my sisters will tell you that in order to love, you must humiliate yourself. She will start the story with a virgin whose hair is black as the bottom of the sea. In her version of the book, the heroine worships a quixotic knight who doesn't adore her, but who wants to release the captive lyrebird in her room. Jealousy marshals fevered blood through her body, so she finds a windmill, which is love disguised, and sets it on fire, which is a prayer for the damned. One sister believes God is a guillotine and love is an oubliette. She knows pain is a condition of truth, and that a fossil leaves two stories. One about unmiraculous fish and loaves and a hill crowded with atheists muttering mass, and one about carbon. She'll tell you the book is about a chariot dragging its charioteer to his death. It's about what the dying man cried out for as the earth broke his body open and the people left behind who worshipped the stones he bled on."
See, I love that. I love that remaking of religion, of myth, of history, of fairy tales. I just think it's absolutely, a beautiful achievement.
Well, in many ways, it's like, it's already the work of a writer, because we live twice. We live our lives, and then we live again when we write. Mm-hmm. And so we're already revising our own experiences into language.
So true.
Well, and then if you want to go back to versions of the Bible and the Council of Nicaea and how choices were made, you could do that if you wanted to. But just also, my desire to give voice to the voiceless, or mm-hmm. to make things speak that weren't speaking. I think we're all constantly revising history and constantly revising stories. And, isn't it Proverbs where it says there's nothing new under the sun? So,
Ecclesiastes.
So, we are just rehearsing, the same stories over and over again, only now there are Walmarts in it and Coca-Cola. It's pretty much the same stuff. But no, it's great. It's a wonderful thing. It means all of our stories are trying, we're still trying to save each other with the same good metaphors. It means that I have great giants whose shoulders I can climb up on, and that I don't have to reinvent the wheel, and I don't have to start from scratch. And it doesn't mean that my poems are any less valid just because they're stealing from the Bible and Joseph Campbell and Emerson and whoever else I'm stealing from. It just means I get to keep building higher. These are our towers of Babel. These are our extra bricks that we're still trying to reach something with. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
What was it? And don't even feel bad about that. Mediocre writers borrow, great writers steal. Who was it who said that? That's like a very famous
That was
quote.
T.S. Eliot,
that
I believe.
I believe it was Eliot.
Well, and as my husband pointed out, if you borrow a car and somebody sees you with their borrowed car down the street, they're going to be like, "Dude, that's my car," because it looks like their car. If you steal a car, you file off the VIN number and get a new rim, get it a paint job and an aftermarket spoiler, and it goes down the street and they're like, "That looks really familiar," but you've stolen it. You've made it yours. Mm-hmm. You've reinvented, mm-hmm. you've reimagined, and that's why you steal, not because it's
not
bad.
Not because you don't have imagination, because
you
want
to remake
it.
But that's how you prove your imagination, mm-hmm. is being a good thief and stealing well and inventing as you steal. Because with borrowing, like, if you've seen people write bad versions of some influence poems, you can totally see how borrowed it is. And if you're a good thief, no one will see whose syntax you're using and whose music and whose sets of images. And so especially if you steal around a lot, if you keep stealing from the same house, they're going to catch on. But if you steal from a lot of places, then no one will recognize once you put it all together, you know? This is why you need it. To steal.
That's great.
Do not be mad at T.S. Eliot for this. I was for many years, and then I caught on what he was really saying.
Well, I would like to... I want you to tell us a little bit about your life. You know, where do you come from? You know, how did you become this... Because you look very young. You know, so how did you... I mean, maybe you're not. Maybe you're one of those people with a baby face. But you look like someone who has... matured as a poet in an interesting way at a very young age. And if you could sort of talk about, you know, maybe your training, influences, things like that, that, you know, just tell us a little bit about.
I think Virginia made me a poet.
Really?
I wrote since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I studied it in undergrad and promptly graduated.
And you did your undergrad?
At Florida State.
At Florida State.
And then promptly stopped writing and got a job. Mm-hmm. And I was working at the American Shakespeare Center in Stanton. Mm-hmm. And I had a job in the arts. I had a house. I had a dog. I had a partner I'd had for years. And it was the most miserable I have ever felt.
Oh, no.
I remember thinking about retirement, and then when that no longer thrilled me, I would think about being dead. Oof. And it took me a while to realize that that wasn't normal. Like, 23-year-olds didn't think about being dead and how relieved they're going to be. Like, 23 is still really young. And so I realized I'd checked everything off that list of the American dream, and even my version of it, like a job in the arts, and like, you know, it should be this perfect thing, and it wasn't. And I remember walking home, and it started raining, and I felt the rain on my skin, and it was the first time I'd felt something in a long time. I'm sure my skin felt rain when I'd walked in it before, but, like, where the sensations really felt real to me, rather than sleepwalking through them. And I needed to love something more than I loved saying what my life was and saying what I did for a living. Mm-hmm. And more than that house and more than that job and more than that man, I had to love something so that I could save my own life. And that thing was poetry. So I sort of ditched my life and moved to New York City to be a writer. And it was terrible and wonderful, and I learned so much, and I worked odd jobs and went back for my master's and just had grand adventures, made myself all sorts of promises. I have an apocalypse list so that I'm trying to get things done before the apocalypse, not before, you know, not a bucket list. I'm not waiting for 65. I'm no longer waiting for retirement or death to have a life I like.
Because the apocalypse could be tomorrow. It could be December 12th, you know, when the Mayan calendar ends. So.
And not to freak me out, because my grandmother always told me I was going to die soon. But so not to scare me, but like to make me really live my life with intention. And I also pretty naturally love to do what I'm most afraid of. Mm-hmm. And so when I walk into an art museum and I see a piece of art that scares me, I walk towards it. And that's the way I went through the Met, because you can't see everything in the Met. But just to always move towards that which I fear most so that I don't have to be afraid anymore. Because I was really tired of being afraid and obeying the rules that said I lived a good life. And I wanted to find out what a good life would feel like if I did what I wanted to do. And I think, you know, it speaks to also that love that I had for poetry. I sort of felt like a freak in grad school a little bit, because no one wanted to talk about poetry as much as I did. No one was obsessed. Sarah Lawrence College. Mm-hmm. Up in
so
New York.
Was Thomas Luck still there at that time?
He comes back for master classes still did at the time I was there. But I think other people loved it or cared about it, or it was a hobby, or they really liked it. But for me, it was how to survive. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people come to writing because they like it or love it, but I needed it. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't save myself there, I didn't know how. And it was basically the last choice, because I had already lived this life that made me wish I was dead. So I had to find a kind of life that made me want to be alive, to reconcile me to life. And so I think I learned quickly too, because I was that obsessed. I read a book of poetry a day. I wrote most days. I was really dedicated. And so I think, I never won any undergraduate awards. My recommendation letter from undergrad spoke to my work ethic, not my talent. I did not get into any grad school the first time I applied. But I can't control how good I am, but I can control how hard I work. And so I focused on that because I'm really good at working hard. And so I just worked hard and really wanted to write good poems.
I
never felt smart. Mm-hmm. I was never the A-plus student. I was never anyone who was picked out as the best of anything. I mm-hmm. was never exceptional. I was just floating around in an above average pool, you know, passing my classes. But I think once something became that necessary to me, it really pushed me to a place that, because love changes your life. It does. Like, even if it's not a person, and especially if it's not a person, because you can love it in a whole different way mm-hmm. and more, more completely isn't fair, but, there's no, you don't have to balance that. You don't have to balance time together with time apart. You don't have to, you know, you can just sleep with your books in your bed. You can do whatever you want with them if that's what your passion is. But a great passion can really change the way you experience the world. And that's what poetry did for me.
Okay. Well, let's give Tracy a hand. We have, you know, a few minutes left. We actually started a little bit late, so we can keep the conversation going.
It's not a question, but it's a comment. Your idea, you write about women, the book is about women, and rather than seeing the positive side of that, some people look at it as the absence of men, and it reminds me of, you know, the glass is half full or half empty. It's kind of how you look at it. And you have such a positive attitude about everything, about life, everything. It's inspiring.
Well, I think that's one of the remarkable things about the book is that, you know, even though it is about this this landscape that is sort of devastated and, you know, terrifying and that has all our sort of like past and future mistakes sort of wound up together, there is this affirmation, this sense of affirmation. There's always the intrusion. There are these intrusions of the natural world that are really interesting. And maybe we could talk a little bit about that, because I'm thinking of a poem like, let's see. I've got all these things underlined. I've just completely annotated this book, so it's kind of like... But there's one that I absolutely love where... it might take me a minute to find this. Oh, yes, in Pilgrimage, where, you know, there's this world of, you know, dead bodies swaying from branches. But then this line that goes, the grass repeats its eternal rumor that everything which dies grows a new body. There's always, like I said, this intrusion of the natural world. It's not pastoral. It's not, you know, nostalgic. It's not sort of like inviting us to imagine some past, gone, ideal world. It's the real world. It's sort of science. It's, you know, it's the balance between life, death, decay, you know, and how the cycle of all of these things feed into each other. And that's where the source of the hope is. So, I mean, would you agree, or was that something that you were after, or...
Well, actually, somebody mentioned the other day something about all the animals in the book, and I was like, oh no, I try not to. It's really interesting that when a couple of the things I knew I was guilty of in the first book is if a small little animal crawled into the poem in the first few lines, they weren't going to get out alive. They just were not going to make it. It was like a horror film for small animals. And I knew I deliberately, like, I was writing a lot about the body, and I was like, clavicle, scapula, like, haven't I named? I was always looking for a new part of the body, and people have both brought up how much I use the body and how much I use nature in this book, and I was like, well, I guess I'm toting those with me forever, mm-hmm. because I can't seem to escape them. But I guess, too, with nature, it is a space of wonder and terror at the same time. You know, awe is a little bit terrible and joy is a little painful, and that things sort of contain their opposites. I guess I'm obsessed with paradox because I think the opposite of most things is true as well. But I think there is affirmation. And I also end with the more positive poems, and the book ends with the line, "Love nails me to the world." Mm-hmm. And like, I think that's just the answer I got. And I appreciate the comment that I'm very positive, because I think people read the book and have commented even like on the headshot that's on my website is like me smiling, and people are like, "But you're so happy. What's with all this darkness?" But there's the Spanish poet Federico García Lorca coined this term called duende, where we go to the dark places to write and we wrestle with our darkness there. And I read in this interview with Neruda that the true tragedy of Lorca's death was that he was a man with a great talent for living, and he was one of the most joyful people Neruda knew. And so that felt so true, and I was so happy to see that this man that we remember very much for his coining of this term about where we go to write art in these dark places, and how his poems contain so much death, that he was a joyful person and that he had a great talent for life. And I think maybe that's part of, if I can go into those art museums and look at the things I fear, if I can write the poems that I'm and say the things I'm afraid to say, that I don't have to be afraid in my life, and I can meet it unafraid, and that maybe that's the life I can be reconciled to. Love can teach me how to live that life.
I think of that Lorca is that's a really good connection. What did the baptism in dark water is that? That's
yes.
What he called it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there, one of the things I think this is of all people, Walter Mosley has written really, really provocatively about his concept of the artist's job, which is serious. The job of art, serious art, is to remind us of our mortality and to help us to confront that, honestly, with clear eyes, hopefully with joy. So, I think that is the source of the book's power, is that it goes to that dark place. But it doesn't leave you stranded, gasping on the shore with absolutely no hope. So I'm kind of interested that the critics seem to.
I mean, lots of people have said lots of nice things.
Yeah.
But it just really hasn't. Even people who really like the book, there just always seems to be this mention about gender, which I just find fascinating because I didn't really even think about it that much when I wrote it, or like, even like, this is my anthem for women. It was just about women, I wasn't trying to be like.
Yes. Yeah. Their problem, not yours.
Yeah. But
you're a woman. Simply.
For some people, it's there is a contradiction between women and serious poetry. For some people,
or women in anything.
Women in
so
anything.
We've got to get over that. It's their problem. That's not your problem. That's their problem.
That's right.
That's how I feel about it, having been there in other ways.
I just hope that it can matter, even though it is women, and that's maybe a silly thing to say, but if people feel shut out from the experiences, then that would lead them to put the book down or to not see it through. And that makes me a little bit sad, but it is their problem.
Right, but what they didn't stand and what you said was, I want it to stand even though it is about women. And it should stand without that last phrase. So, which is the sense that I got in your conversation here with Kendra, that it would stand.
There's a clause that's in the book, but it stands on it.
So, that made me sad that you had to put "even if" in that sentence, because you didn't need that unless, for some reason, these comments are bothering you.
Well, I think it just happens to a lot of women's poetry or things. People will say things about like, I don't want to read another poem about a woman breastfeeding or something. Like, people make these comments, and but no one says, I don't want to read another poem about a boy shooting a BB gun. Like, they don't make the gender comment
maybe
the opposite way.
Well, just to be fair, I will tell you, if I saw a poem about about football. I wouldn't read it, probably.
Or even baseball, or any of the sports, I would probably say, oh, it's one of those.
Another baseball poem.
It's another your guns and your poems.
But the thing is that I try to keep an open mind if I feel that way, and at least read the first line or two. Then they better get me there. But and again, I mean, my favorite book in the whole world, and I know it's hard to pick a favorite, but it definitely is the Autumn of the Patriarch. And that is about something I have no interest in at all. I'm not interested in military. As a matter of fact, I dislike it. You know, it's about really a man. And I mean, it's just bizarre that I love it, but it's the way it's written.
Well, I invite you to read Tracy's books because of the way they are written. I mean, the girl could write. Straight up.